Planet Perth Season 2 is sponsored by Lawson Flats, Perth's newest club for creatives to work, connect and play. Learn more at lawsonflats.com. So when did Rajneesh appear? For you?
When you arrived in Pune, you had what was called a darshan, which was a kind of a meeting, and there was what they called an arrival darshan, so the newcomers could come and you would file into an auditorium, a small auditorium, sit on a marble floor, and then you would wait, and there might be 100 others, there might be more, I can't remember exactly. He appeared, and he would sit in his chair, and then you would be called up, and you would be... have a question perhaps for him, you might get a few words of welcome, and then you'd go back to your place and then somebody else would come up. So that was the first initial meeting, and it was, well, for me it was spellbinding.
What would you do if your neighbourhood was suddenly infiltrated by a cult? Former lawyer and author Bruce Menzies was a young, educated family man when he decided to join in.
You know, you're looking into this, these eyes of this man who absolutely, you're in that energy, in that space of being recognised. That's how it felt. It felt like somebody's actually looking into you and looking through you. So that was an experience in itself.
The Sannyasins, colloquially known as the Orange People, arrived in Perth, Fremantle, in the early 1980s. In fact, the port city became a hub for followers of Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, also known as Osho, an Indian guru who aimed to expand consciousness through sex and meditation. Though the group captured the imagination of locals, they also drew harsh criticism for their sexual practices, eccentric leaders, and plans to establish a base in the great southern town of Pemberton. What made them so captivating to locals? And why did a global movement set up shop in our isolated port city?
What happens around these teachers is a lot to do with power, sex, and money.
The more people I talk to, the more I'm really concerned about the human dynamics and the trauma that these groups are causing.
Perth has a particular interest in spiritual teachers because we do all live in our own little worlds here.
A lot of us during our time with Rajneesh ignored that bullshit detector.
We're about to find out in this episode of Planet Perth. Perth is one of the most isolated cities in the world. So far removed from the rest of the globe, it might as well be its own planet. Join me, Jeff Bullen, as I take a deep dive into the weird, wacky, and unexplained history of our eccentric city, digging up memories of bygone icons, personalities, and events. This is Planet Perth. ...1980s Fremantle was a vibrant melting pot of culture and activity.
Fremantle was a really vibrant environment back then. Like at my primary school, half of the kids were probably first generation from migrant families, mainly Italian. And then there was this other wave of migration, I suppose. I watched friends change from their names, their sort of English given names, to these Hindu names. And that was the Sannyas movement. So I watched as their parents joined and their lives changed and this new culture really emerged before me.
That was documentary filmmaker Joseph London. His short film, The Beloved, portrays the Orange People as they slowly wove themselves into the fabric of Fremantle and the Great Southern.
I grew up right in the middle of Fremantle, just sort of behind in one of the streets behind a real hub of Fremantle back then, which was a cafe called Papa Luigi's. Well, because what happened really is in the 70s, artists and intellectuals and people who wanted something different to what to the that kind of suburban experience of Perth started moving into Fremantle,
right?
And finding this amazing like Italian fishing village. It was really run down. It was mainly Italian. Like most of the shops were Italian. The banks had translators for English speakers,
right,
because they were more Italian than English. And I think also it's been described as a place where that people would move when the commune failed. You know, it was this nice medium of community and culture. And so this was the sort of the early 80s when this was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And then it would have been 1981 when an ashram for the Sannyasins was set up right around the corner from where I lived, just opposite the Esplanade Park.
Right.
And that became a real hub and slowly made its presence felt in Fremantle.
Joseph spent years researching and interviewing members of the movement, which centred around the guru Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, otherwise known as Osho. Osho was an Indian self-help guru who attracted thousands of followers around the world for his talks on sexual revolution and expanding consciousness.
How it all started was a man called, he was born Chandra Mohan Jain. He studied philosophy and became a very young professor of philosophy. So he was extremely well-versed in various philosophies and extremely eloquent. He spoke perfect English and he wasn't afraid to express ideas that were controversial. So one of his very early ideas was how sex was a way of accessing the superconsciousness, was a way of having an enlightenment experience. So this obviously caused a lot of scandal in India, but also brought him a lot of attention.
Mm-hmm.
Alongside that, he also developed, from other ideas he'd seen around, a different form of meditation, which was very active. So it was rather than sitting mm-hmm. and attempting to access that other realm, that other space of consciousness, he felt that it needed to be a kind of a staged and very physical process. So that involved a lot of catharsis, involved a lot of movement, and then at the final stage of that meditation, there would be silence and trying to tune into that awareness that was all about enlightenment. And then in the early 70s, a few people had sort of recognised him as this, as having a kind of a charismatic presence. And by that I mean one of these people who seem to affect other people's consciousness when they come into his presence. So they sort of drop in this into this kind of somatic state when they're around him. And a few people started recognising this and making a space for others to sit with him.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had this room in this Bombay apartment block that where people would visit. And in the 70s, you're probably aware that India became a real part of this overland trip that Westerners did.
The hippie trail.
The hippie trail, in other words, where they started becoming more aware of these Eastern religions and Eastern philosophies and were looking for people who could allow them to access this space that seemed to be so different to the kind of religions that they grew up in. Well, and obviously all the other religions they came across were quite strict still, and there was a lot of sort of sitting still and denying yourself sex or denying yourself, you know, had very prescribed ways of eating. And there was this man telling you that sex was a way to your super consciousness and was able to speak perfect English. And so his Western following grew until it got to a point where after I think a wealthy Greek heiress became a disciple of his and set up for him an ashram in this quite well-to-do suburb of Pune, a city south of Mumbai, and that's where things really started to get to take off. Rajneesh was always a nickname for him, and Bhagwan means it means God, or it means a kind of a holy.
Wow, that's a big title.
It's a big title, and it was either given to him or negotiated with him. And at this point, he started. He was wearing sort of a white, almost looked like a sari. And so he really looked the part. He had a long black beard. He was at this time. He was this quite strong-looking man with intense eyes. And when they moved him to Pune, around that time is when he started being referred to as Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, and people started coming and seeing his discourses, which is these what was the name given to the talks he would give. And there would be one every single day, and he would give one in Hindi and one in English. And he got to the point where people wanted him to be their spiritual teacher.
Gotcha.
And was
so a bigger, grander title was required to command that respect.
Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, he'd sort of arrived as a spiritual master.
Wow. Though he never made the trip down under, he slowly but surely garnered a strong following in Frio.
The reason that it all took off in Perth in such a way was that there was a psychologist from Perth who was introduced to his ideas in the early 70s and immediately took off to India and took sannyas. And so his name was Indivar. He's someone who can still be found. He still works as a psychologist. But he came back to Perth with another couple of people from Perth who he'd met over there, and they set up a little kind of ashram themselves out in the bush near Jandakot. And people started hearing about this and going there and doing the meditations, doing those group therapy workshops, and it really started to become this experience that people started telling others about. And people started taking sannyas and wearing the colours, and obviously that was an incredible advertisement for people and to ask questions and to find out more about it, and that's really how it grew. So really in the early stages until 1981, it was just this centre down in Jandakot called Shanti Sadan, and then there was a little bookshop run out of Victoria Park, and that was it. They were the two little kind of meeting places for sannyasins in Perth, more or less. But obviously people had started seeing them around and going, what is this? What is going on? The goal at that time, rather than remain in your hometown and be a sannyasin and cop all the heat that that involved, was to get to India and be around the master and be part of this movement. So people would sell off their houses, leave their careers behind, take their whole families and set up their new life in Pune. They thought they were there forever. And in Fremantle back then, they only chose Fremantle because it was cheap.
Cheap,
essentially. It was so cheap. And they leased this enormous, magnificent trades hall, which is sort of opposite the Esplanade Hotel, which is over the road from the Esplanade Park, and bought this building opposite. It was called the Old Oceanic Hotel. And so they made the trades hall their centre, their ashram, where they would all eat, where they would do their dynamic meditations, where they set up a cafe and a restaurant. And over the road, they did that up and turned that into, one of the commune houses.
It's where you live.
That's right.
Wow.
Yeah, everyone was on a high. They discovered this new philosophy, this new way of life. And even though it was causing massive problems with their own families, they had sort of discovered a true path for themselves.
Until 1981, sannyasins only occupied a small pocket of Perth. But political, economic, and health pressures on the ashram in India forced the displacement of sannyasins back to their hometowns. For a vast majority of sannyasins, that meant returning to sleepy Fremantle. For former sannyasin Bruce Menzies, however, his journey with the group was only just beginning, making his way to the guru's infamous hub in Oregon, USA. Despite being sceptical of the woo-woo nature of the movement's more spiritual elements, Bruce found meaning and a sense of purpose that challenged the status quo of suburban life in Perth.
Planet Perth.
As I said, I was living and married and working. I was actually working as a lawyer down in Fremantle at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Late 20s, early 30s. We had friends who lived across the lane from us, Roger and Jane, who also were attracted, and they had friends suddenly who were wearing orange.
Yep.
And then Roger and Jane became involved, and then they told us about how wonderful it was going out to this centre called Shanty Sedan, and we thought, oh, we'll give it a try. So both my wife and I went out there with our kids, sometimes just for a day, perhaps on a Saturday, and you'd mix with people, you'd do some meditations. And then what would happen in Pune is that when Rajneesh would give a discourse, which lasted usually about an hour and a half in the morning, the transcript of that was turned into a book, or
right.
a number of discourses usually became a book, and that book came out. And so those books became available in Australia, as did cassette tapes. There were that old technology.
Yeah.
That very old technology of cassette. So we were listening to his voice, this voice on tape, and we were reading his books. And so we were forming an attraction. I was forming certainly an attraction.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one part of me was basically saying, what the hell's all this about? This is not me. You know, I'm, you know, the last person to be attracted to anything that might be called, in inverted commas, spiritual.
Mm.
That's not my background. If I'd had to self-describe, I would have said I'm an agnostic, you know. Certainly, I didn't have a heavy-duty religious background. But at the same time, I could feel myself being pulled towards what was being said.
I mean, in terms of agnosticism, it wasn't exactly saying there was a God, so...
Yeah, I didn't really have any interest in it.
There was no need for that.
No, it wasn't something that called to me. Whereas for you know,
so it didn't like interrupt your agnosticism at all.
It didn't. Well, it did. Yeah. Because it really undermined this whole thing about spirituality. To me, at that stage, was some kind of woo-woo, you know, airy fairy kind of thing that people might talk about. But it just didn't resonate. I'd tried to read one or two books, but they didn't. And this was not necessarily typical of other people who were attracted. Some people came from very intense religious backgrounds,
right,
who were looking for something a little different, but they'd had this percolating for a long time. I didn't see it. All that I could, you know, when I looked at what was happening for me, I could see that I'd been looking for something, but I didn't know what. And I was very good at sitting in the armchair and pontificating what was wrong with the world, but I had no bloody idea really, you know, where I wanted to go. And that was reflected in the way I worked. It was reflected in the way I had relationship with friends, and that I always felt like I could handle things, you know, from an intellectual or verbal point of view, but to actually be vulnerable and humble about anything, you know, that wasn't me at the time. So I went through a year after first encountering these books and these tapes of listening and absorbing and talking to other people and seeing what happened out at this meditation center. I think we did a couple of kind of group therapy things out there at the time, and I could feel the pull, but I could also feel a very strong resistance.
Yeah.
And then one night I was lying doing a meditation, and I kind of flipped out and over, and I said to myself, I've been saying why for 12 months. And then the question just suddenly turned, and it became, why not? And when it became why not, it was obvious. So I jumped in. But it took me 12 months, whereas for my wife, she was just kind of in very quickly, and for others, they knew from the start, you know, that was for them. Others were probably like me. It took longer.
So you've been pointed in the direction of Rajneesh inside here in Perth. What got you over there?
Well, that was a process in itself because I was working full time. Our little boys at that stage were probably 4 and 6 years of age. We had, they were going to a Montessori school. My wife at the time and I had been involved in setting up what's now the Beehive Montessori School in North Fremantle, and we'd put a heart and soul into that. So we were under quite a lot of pressure in our own relationship. And I think at that point, there became a reckoning whether we were going to stay together. And I suspect in hindsight, it was like this provided an opening. But at the same time, it was a huge challenge because none of our close friends and certainly our families could understand at all what was going on for us, even though we tried in our, you know, our not so humble ways to kind of convey what was happening. But it became very clear that if we were really going to commit to this, we had to go the whole way.
Yeah.
And so at that point, we put our house on the market. I resigned from my job. I was about to be given a partnership in a law firm, which was a big deal in those days.
Indeed.
So I was throwing all that career thing away. And we ended up selling up at probably in 1978, towards the end of 1978, and we moved holus bolus to Purna. I had already what they call taking sannyas. So taking sannyas made you made a commitment to become an orange-clad disciple, and you could do that by writing a letter from Perth. You didn't have to actually be in Purna to do that, although some did. Some went to Purna before they took up that disciplehood aspect. I'd written off a letter and I'd got a new name and I'd got the so-called mala, which is the pendant and the beads that hang around the neck, and I'd got those back in Perth. So I hadn't actually met him in the flesh at that stage. It felt a natural step once I'd decided to say yes to it. What was very difficult was that we took ourselves away from our familiar friendship groups. And so that was very hard for other people. And it was particularly hard on my family. I mean, my parents and my former wife's parents were devoted to the little kids, the grandchildren. And here are the two of us deciding that we're going off to India and we're taking the kids with us and we're never coming back.
Okay, so you've needed to decamp to Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And you were one of the first people over there.
I was very much in the early contingent because I had been working in the accounts department in Pune, but doing kind of quasi-legal work. And there was another guy, an Irishman, who was also a trained lawyer. And he and I were really, at that point, the only available sannyasin lawyers. So I got a kind of a free ticket to Oregon in the very early days, 2 months after the commune there started. So this is September of 1981.
And things started off pretty cool there, right? I mean, from what I understood, the people of Antelope were, like the people of Fremantle, a bit indifferent, like, there's a few more people around.
Well, I can't speak for the people of Antelope, but we were a presence, a small presence early on. I think when I went
on there, a huge property,
there might have been 80 or 90 on this property, which is, as I told you, 126 square miles on
massive,
high desert of Oregon with juniper trees and sagebrush and a stream running through. So it's a disused, rundown cattle ranch, and with lots of erosion and all of that. Oregon was the little village hamlet that was located, the closest sort of township to the actual what we called the ranch property, the commune there. And so those people were generally old-timers, farmers, shopkeepers, and so forth. And our presence quickly became very problematic for them because we looked at buying up their properties, and in a sense we were forcing them out of town because we had the purchasing power, and we had the intent. And what had been relatively benign at first quickly ran off the rails. Part of our motivation was to take over the town council so that we had a presence, a political presence within that community.
And that certainly put them offside fairly rapidly.
Absolutely.
And then I guess things just snowballed from there as they gathered support from politicians or like on a broader scale.
Yeah, we were really focused on getting the community up and running, and we would use pretty much whatever means that we could devise that were mostly smoke screens. We went there saying that we were a farming community, and in fact we were trying to establish a city and we were going to have a very small community, and all of a sudden we were talking about 10,000 or 5,000 people. And of course we were, you know, flying in the face of land use laws that were, you know, the property was zoned rural, mm-hmm. so it wasn't really a city property. There were also immigration issues because a lot of us had to get there on tourist visas, whereas we intended to stay for as long as we could. And there were issues with him. I mean, he, Roshnish himself, I mean, he was billed as a spiritual leader, and basically they were trying to get an immigration visa for him on that basis. But there were a lot of smoke screens around what we built and how we operated. And, of course, on the one hand, the Oregon tradespeople were getting a lot of work from us. We were bringing in mobile homes. We were doing all this and that. But we were obviously going to be an economic force and perhaps useful from that point of view. But we were also getting up the noses in other ways.
Did you find that smokescreen process a bit contradictory to what the approaches were of the movement?
At the time, I wasn't particularly worried about things as long as they didn't seem to have a direct effect on others.
Yeah.
When I was pretty close to what was going on in those early stages, because I was still within that early legal department in Oregon, but when I saw what was happening in Antelope, I did see that it was a huge deception.
Planet Perth.
Humans love drama, scandal, and crime. That's why we're often so fascinated by cults. But winding up one isn't as simple as just joining.
Yeah, this is one of the most, I would say, widely misunderstood things about cults. And it was one of the first questions I had, absolutely, when I started the project. But now I really have come to understand that, you know, nobody is going out there and joining a cult. All they're doing is joining a group that seems that it is wonderful, and it could be any kind of group, any kind of community, organisation.
That was Sarah Steele, Australian filmmaker, author and host of Let's Talk About Sex podcast. She says there are still damaging misconceptions and stigma surrounding why people join cultic groups.
You know, I looked at a Canadian group that was like an activist socialist group. So it can be anything. Like, I could go and join a book club because I was in the community, and it could turn, if the wrong people were at the top, it could turn out to be a cult. And so what people are doing is that they're just joining a group that turns out to be a cult. And there are so many, like, wonderful communities out there, new religious movements, that aren't cults. They are offering something for people who are, you know, often they're seekers, that they have a real lot to contribute because they're idealistic and they really want to give of themselves. But if you've come across the wrong group at the wrong point in your life, and really that could be any one of us, because we all have vulnerable points in our lives. It's not vulnerable people, it's kind of vulnerable life stages, although, you know, more vulnerable people have more vulnerable life stages. So I think that's a huge misunderstanding. People can fall into these groups in any number of ways, and it happens slowly over time, and it kind of creeps up on you, and all of a sudden you do find yourself trapped. You've kind of frozen out all your external relationships. All of your relationships are within this group, and so it can be really hard to get out. But the other thing that's really important to keep in mind is that many, many people never chose to join in the first place because they were born into their cult.
Yes. So how do you draw the line between esoteric or quirky and cultish? Sarah says there are several important red flags to identify cults.
If you're looking at a group that is promising transformation to your life, but there doesn't ever seem to be an end point in sight, or any group that says that it has all of the answers, and any person that requires for you to refer to them in order to answer, like, any of the small questions in your life, and when they start to, like, exhibit controls over things, you know, a lot of these groups, they'll have influence over whether you can procreate, whether you can have a relationship with your children, what type of relationship you can have with your children, who you can marry, and these kinds of things. When the financial obligations are, you know, a little too taxing, And just, yeah, when decision-making processes are being taken from the individual and they're not really empowering you to fix your own life and to come out of it at the other end, I would say a huge red flag also is that when former members they're not wishing the best for former members. They're isolating themselves from former members. They're not listening to any complaints that come forward, like I already mentioned. But members aren't encouraged to have relationships with those who've left. Because most healthy groups, if someone passes through them and moves on, you wish the best for that person and you stay in touch, right?
Right. Well, you'd think so. You've, you know, shared a common philosophy for a while.
Yeah, and that doesn't happen in cultic groups. It's always people who've left are seen as a failure in some way and you're not to have a relationship with them. And a lot of people, I would suggest, would prefer not to follow a belief system that, you know, has been used in those ways. And so there are certain, like yoga ashrams that I've come across that have been abusive, and people, they just won't use those specific teachings because they just don't think that it's ethical to do so anymore. So there's something to be said about ethical consumption, but then there are definitely groups that they can become non-abusive. And if the teachings at their core aren't the abusive elements of the organisation, I think it can be fine to still follow them.
I mean, I personally think the best anti-cult piece of television is that Simpsons episode. With the
which one is that?
There's a fantastic one where a cult leader comes to town. You know, it's all the leader is good, the leader is great, you know, and they can't get Homer to say the leader is good, the leader is great. So they finally work out the only way to get him to chant something is, you know, you go, na 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 na, leader, leader, leader.
It's no use. He's obviously the most powerful mind we've ever dealt with.
Or... na 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 leader. Na 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 leader.
Na 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 leader. Leader. Leader.
Batman. I mean, leader. I love the leader.
Yeah, so anyhow, and then eventually, Homer unwittingly uncovers the leader as the sham that he is. By the time Bhagwan moved from his ashram in India to Oregon in 1981, his message of free love and mysticism had spread far and wide.
What had happened was, for a long time before that, he had put the feelers out for a new commune. Pune was getting too small. It had thousands of people living there.
And he had some issues, unknown.
And he had all sorts of issues. So it was overcrowded in the ashram, and Western sannyasins were sort of spilling out into the city, and they were sort of their presence was resented by, you know, many of the locals. The strange solution that was found, because at the time he had another secretary called Lakshmi, and in a way there was a kind of a competition between her and a new emerging close confidant of his, Ma Sheela, to find the next commune.
A controversial figure, Sheela was eventually credited with the downfall of the sannyasin movement for her treatment of its members and the wider Oregon community.
And Lakshmi looked mainly in India and couldn't really find a suitable place. But Sheela had married an American guy. And so she had spent some time in America and looked in America. And she came back with this, she'd found this incredible ranch, this huge ranch, which was sort of, had been used in a couple of westerns with John Wayne. It was right. That sort of environment. And so that's where they set up. But it was really difficult country to build in. It wasn't, they weren't allowed to build, accommodation there. It was really meant to be farmland.
Right.
So they went through a lot of hardship initially. It was really hot in the summer, freezing cold in the winter with, you know, 6 feet of snow. But they brought over this initial working group that started building accommodation for everyone to come and join them there. That was the idea. So people will return to their home countries until they were sort of called,
yep,
ready to
cash up.
To join this and to cash up. And in Fremantle back then, they only chose Fremantle because it was cheap.
Cheap,
essentially.
Yeah.
It was so cheap. And they leased this enormous, magnificent trades hall, which is sort of opposite the Esplanade Hotel, which is over the road from the Esplanade Park, and bought this building opposite. It was called the Old Oceanic Hotel. And so they made the trades hall their centre, their ashram, where they would all eat, where they would do their dynamic meditations, where they set up a cafe and a restaurant. And over the road, they did that up and turned that into, one of the commune houses.
It's where you live.
That's right.
Wow. So the local people were cool with it, or they're just the people that were offloading property were going like, wacko, we're getting a good price here, so...
There was a little bit of kickback in initially, because back then in the early 80s, Fremantle, as I mentioned, was very run down.
Mm.
And a lot of the buildings and the houses in and around Fremantle were occupied by ex-seafarers and people who used to work at the wharf. But, basically these houses for older guys who were spending a lot of their pension on alcohol, like right over the road from us.
Yeah.
We had a couple. This was on, around the corner from the trades hall. And the Oceanic Hotel was one of those. So it was full of these men who were, many of them were sort of just drinking themselves.
Seeing out their days in retirement from the wharf.
Pretty much.
At the bar.
And then buying that building meant that they all had to move out. And so there was a big uproar about that. There was even a march and things like that. So they really saw, strangely, they saw the, a lot of locals saw the arrival of the Sanyasins initially as this sort of, this wealthy group moving into the centre, gentrifying things and changing Fremantle. After that, the locals sort of appreciated the eccentricities of this new group.
The Indian guru had previously denounced wealth, but soon his ranch became a money-making machine with millions of dollars funneled from his global followers, including Fremantle, into his desert oasis. It's reported an estimated $130 million poured into the ranch between 1981 and 1985. One of the most iconic displays of the Bhagwan's accumulating wealth was his $7 million Rolls-Royce collection. He even had his own airline, Air Rajneesh. Over in Fremantle, problems amplified when the sassy secretary of the guru followed the money down under. Ma Sheila came to prominence in Australia after appearing on 60 Minutes, where in an interview she infamously proclaimed tough titties when it was suggested that people of Pemberton were upset about the orange people in their close-knit rural town.
And so in early 1985, Sheila came to Fremantle, and that was Australia's first real encounter with this woman.
And Sheila liked what she saw.
I'm not really sure about what she thought of Fremantle, but she definitely saw it as a community she could make the most of in terms of money and control, because she was welcomed here. The Fremantle Commune obviously thought this was a huge honour.
Well, they were gagging for contact with the leader.
The leader, that's right. And so to have Sheila come here felt like a huge acknowledgement of what they'd been doing.
So did she start taking a deeper philosophical control of the people here?
There didn't seem to be much philosophy going on with Sheila. She was really seemed to be about power and money, and immediately when she got here, she made changes. In the early days of the ranch, for example, in the early days of the ashram here, they limited the number of people with children who could join the commune, because of how distracting it was to their ability to work in the commune, because they obviously had to parent as well. And the kids sort of lived in a local house, or even down at Shanty Sedan for a while. That's where they were, there was a sort of a house parent, so to speak, who would look after them. This is a whole,
wow.
This is a big issue in the
So all the movement. Kids would be grouped together and...
If you were part of the commune, yeah, all the kids lived separately. But they would still see their parents daily for the meals and things like that, but obviously not as much as the nuclear family or all the kids or probably the parents would have liked. And they were taken by a bus to the local schools and then picked up, taken to the meals at the ashram and then taken home again. But when Sheila got there, she obviously wanted the commune to be as big as possible. So she said, everyone can join. And so what she did is set up a kind of a school and a place for the kids to live down at one of this local, this Perth millionaire called Jay Harmond owned this property down near Pemberton called Carrie Valley. And so all the kids at that point were sent there. And Carrie Valley's hours away, and some kids moved down there and didn't see their parents for months at a time, and kids as young as two were sent, and that's remained a kind of a bruise within the memory of Sanyasins, I think.
Did it raise the attention of child services here in Perth?
It did, because eventually they got closed down. But, they were running a school and there was a lot of controversy about this, and the Pemberton locals were really kicking up a storm because of what they'd been hearing about Antelope back in America, where they'd taken over this town. And
they were worried about the same thing happening within that district.
They were worried about the same thing, and Sheila and even Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh at that time were doing nothing to ease their concerns. They were very provocative in how they spoke about it, and in fact that's where Sheila's immortal line Tough Titties comes from, when she was told the people at Pemberton don't want the Rajneeshis, they don't want you living in their town, and she said, what can I say, tough titties.
Why do you think she took such a combative attitude?
I think she was trying to imitate the master,
right?
Because he was far cleverer and more charming and funnier about it. She did not have his tact and didn't care how she trampled over people in order to do things. He would say things to kind of challenge the person, but there was always a more gentle teasing nature to it.
Did you ever have the opportunity to meet Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh? Or indeed, did you have the opportunity to meet Ma Anand Sheila?
Neither, not to my memory. She was in Fremantle for quite some time.
Could have bumped into her while you were having a coffee somewhere?
I could have bumped into her. I was very young at this stage. 85, I would have been 7. But I do remember friends of mine being sent to Carrie Valley and them disappearing for months. But I never encountered either of them personally, to my knowledge. Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh actually never came to Australia himself, despite...
He never actually set foot on the...
Never set foot in Australia, despite teasing many times that that could happen any day.
Curious, given that he had such a large following here.
He did, but he also had a huge following in England and America and other places too.
It was around this turbulent time that Bruce's stay in Oregon came to an end, and he moved back to life in Perth, but the transition wasn't easy.
So there were a host of illegal things and criminal things that were instigated, and you can certainly find a lot of information about it, but they were clearly you know, off the wall, and some of the behaviours that were happening. And you've got to bear in mind that, you know, the vast majority of people who were there knew nothing about what was going on, because it was very much a kind of a paranoid atmosphere that developed around the top. So mm-hmm. things were held very close to the chest, and different people might hear rumours or feel disturbed, but not really know what was lying underneath all of that. And so most of us didn't get to hear of what was happening.
Mm.
And that's no excuse in a sense, but we were, you know, so busy working. And at the same time, we were also probably, we could probably not comprehend that things would have ever gone as bad as they did. And then, of course, Sheila fell out with Rajneesh, and she and her group all left because they knew that the party was coming to an end and that the law was going to be catching up. And then within a short time after that, Rajneesh flew out in a different direction with his entourage, and he got intercepted and brought back, and he did a plea bargain, actually, with the court system there, and he was allowed to get out and go off elsewhere, get out of America.
Mm.
And I think that was a clever move on the part of the authorities, because they knew that once he left, the rationale for any disciples or followers being there would have gone, and everybody would leave. And that's pretty much what happened. And we're talking now at the end of 1985, so we've been in Oregon between, you know, the middle of 81 to the end of 85. So within that time, there was a hell of a lot that happened. I mean, you could write 3 books about that period of time.
So that last week, those last days, when did it dawn on you that you were heading off?
Well, the alternatives were to either stay, if you were allowed to, and be part of the cleanup crew, or to go back to Australia, and for me, and to see what kind of life could be found here. And it was clear, I think, at that point for me that the party had come to an end. I had already realised that, you know, that this was not for me. So it took me quite a while to extract, because all my eggs had been in that basket.
Had Rajneesh left any instructions on how to reintegrate into society, or were you left up to your own devices from that point onward?
Not explicit instructions as such, no. But, I mean, the major message was that everybody, their transformation was their personal responsibility, and that, you know, you did what you did to try and understand where that awareness, where that meditation might take you. And so what I found useful, I guess, was that a lot of that had been inculcated in a way that I was able to integrate both into the way I came back to Australia and into my subsequent working life. So there were bonuses that had been there. I mean, I'm sure I changed through that period of time. I did. But on the other side of the coin, there was a great sense of loss and sadness for most people, and also anger, confusion, because our investment had been so
complete.
So complete, exactly.
I mean, so you've arrived back in Fremantle. There's still a fair...
Not exactly in Fremantle straight away.
No?
We landed and stayed with my parents for a number of weeks, and that was an experience in itself.
Wow,
we're all concerned.
That would have been...
It took me a little while to get down to Fremantle.
Your mother must have been quite relieved.
Well, in many ways she was, of course.
Lovely to have her son and grandkids back.
Both my parents were.
But then you found your way to Fremantle. Was the movement still alive in Fremantle at that stage?
Oh, yes. Yeah. It's just that the centre changed location a few times, but there was a centre down there in one form or another. And there, basically, most of us, we were like displaced persons in many ways, without much of an idea of how we would reintegrate and what we would do. And it became a financial imperative quite quickly for
people. Did you go back to law, or?
I did. I went back to law, but not initially. I resisted that very strongly. When I first went back there, I worked as a gardener for about $8 an hour, or as a, you know, I think I even did a bit of cleaning, quite menial things, because I like a lot of people, the adjustment was tremendous, because it was as though the rug had been pulled out from underneath us, and we were displaced in many ways. So we sought solace in our own company, but by the same token, I was very conscious that this wasn't going to be my life. There wasn't going to be a communal life for me at that point. And I was lucky, because my partner, who's now my wife, she shared the same view. And so actually, after spending some time, we actually managed to buy a little house in Fremantle and stayed there for a few years, sold up then and went down to Denmark and lived down in Denmark for 15 years. So, and reinvented ourselves down there. I worked part-time as a lawyer. I'm in Fremantle. I worked full-time for a couple of years before we went to Denmark, and then we went down to Denmark and I worked part-time, and then became a mediator, and also we ran some holiday cottages. So I described that because this became, for many people who had been involved, they had to find a new way of living. For some people that hadn't had children, that could still have children, they started to have families and go back into living in nuclear families. Others were in shared households. But in terms of communal activities, there was still a center functioning, there were still meditations taking place, and still, and there still is. Still is a group of people who are not necessarily living within Fremantle, but around the area, because Fremantle became very expensive after the American Stuff, as you know, and that. And so people lived in Hilton and Hammy Hill and places like that, and still do, and still meet with each other. And I don't call myself a sannyasin, but those that do just wear ordinary clothes. So you wouldn't, unless you knew them or knew their past, you wouldn't know that they had been involved.
Though Bruce doesn't regret his choice to join the movement, he says he's still processing his time with the guru, and that the search for meaning and belonging is one that transcends generations.
You know, I'm looking back 40 years now, and the choice I made then, I'm not sorry for the choice. I'm not sorry because it taught me a lot about myself. It taught me a lot about other people. It gave me skills that I otherwise may not have acquired. And I'm much more relaxed, I suppose, as in my own skin. Even though at the time when I was, you know, a successful young lawyer, and I looked from the outside to be a happy family man, which I was in many ways, at the same time there was an underlying disquiet, and that disquiet is gone. I feel very, very comfortable in the way I am, which doesn't mean complacency, I hope. You know, it means that I'm still open to influence, but by the same token, hopefully a little bit more discerning than I was 40 years ago. I follow a little bit of what's happening around the so-called spiritual scene, and there are many, many people who go under the rubric of being a spiritual teacher these days. Many more choices around that than there were at the time that, you know, I was being involved in one particular, with one particular guru. But now there are people from all countries who give some kind of inspiration through their own teachings and what they do. But what I often find is that people go to them with the same kind of naivety, if you like, that was present when I was younger. And they go there, and more often than not, it seems that what happens around these teachers is a lot to do with power, sex, and money. You know, that hardy trifecta that I describe. And people go there expecting these teachers to be free of all of that. But of course, not all of them are. Many of them aren't. And there are just as many disasters, I think, happening around spiritual movements now as there were then. So I don't know what lessons have been learned. I'm not in a position to say. I think a lot of younger people are still searching in one form or another. And, you know, a lot of people throw in their hat with the environment movement. That wasn't so prevalent. I was coming out of a kind of a Vietnam War situation. So our rebellion was really against the conservatism of our parents and the war that was around that we weren't necessarily in favour of. These days, the challenges on young people and their focus can be more around the environment. So what can form around there will be an outlet that maybe I would have taken had I been born 40 years later. But certainly, from what I can see, there are still many, many people that are attracted to these kind of spiritual teachers, probably with the same kind of pitfalls.
Thank you to Bruce Menzies, Sarah Steele and Joseph London for joining us on Planet Perth. My name is Jeff Bullen, host of Planet Perth, and our executive producer is Danielle Raphael. Our assistant producer is Rachel Ng. The theme music you're hearing right now is Can't Blame the City by local band The Mackerels. Our artwork is by Hannah Coakley. This podcast was recorded and produced at RTR FM on Whadjuk Noongar Boodja. We pay our respects to elders past and present. This land was never ceded. Next time on Planet Perth, a country within a country. Only in WA would we find such a thing. A small micronation called the Hutt River Province. That's next time on Planet Perth. Planet Perth Season 2 is sponsored by Lawson Flats, Perth's newest club for creatives to work, connect and play. Learn more at lawsonflats.com.